session number 22170, rule 6.
Rule 6. When I got back to England, I phoned my mother. I remember the telephone number, and still to this day, Ealing 2826. And a voice on the other end said, "Hello, this is Ealing 2826. And I said, "And what are you doing there?" He said, "I'm in your bleeding bed." And it was Bill Ransfield. He hadn't gone home to Australia. He then asked me to be best man at his wedding. He pinched one of my girlfriends and lived in Aussie happily with us trying to contact one another for the next 40 years.
Do you know where he lived in Australia?
Yeah, he lived in Bondi Beach. And every time he had somebody coming back to England, he would say, "I know my buddy lives somewhere in Ealing, London. Look up the telephone directory." But of course, by that time, my father had moved to Southend, retired from Barclays Bank, and Nick Berryman was nowhere to be found in a London telephone directory. Every Australian I ever met, I would say, "Do you know a bloke called Bill Ransfield?" Because we'd lost touch. I had his sister's address, but we had lost touch. And life in those days was such that as young men, aged 25, 24, that we had an awful lot to do. We had to make our way in life. We weren't skilled at any job. What was I? One minute I'm a bank schoolboy, next minute I'm a bank clerk, and the next minute I'm a pilot. And what am I next? As it so happened, I became a motor engineer. And that was only because I married Valerie and her father was a motor engineer. But I, at the moment, we've got as far as Ealing. And Ealing, "Don't come home," he said, "I'm in your bleeding bed." So he takes this girl back to Australia. I was best man at his wedding. And I had to report to Fighter Command Headquarters at Bentley Priory. And I went out there with my hat on my head and my two rings on my tunic, and they said, "What do you do, Flight Lieutenant?" So I said, "I'm a Spitfire pilot." And they said, "What, flying a walrus?" I said, "Yes, a Spitfire pilot flying a walrus." Well, I think they took two breaths and decided this man was either nuts or big-headed or something odd about him. So they posted me to a flying instructional school in Montrose in Scotland, and I was to become a flying instructor. But before that, I had to take 8 weeks' course. Unbeknown to me, by this time, of course, I had also collected McKenty, the Springer. And it was very, very delightful to realise that while other people were fighting a war, I was swanning along in Scotland, being looked after by some very delightful WAF women who would give me my breakfast, my dinner and my tea, would keep me clean, tidy, polish my buttons and my shoes, and to boot, I had my lovely Springer Spaniel back with me. And he was an absolute delight to have up in the Scottish
lot. Did he know you straight away?
Oh, he did. He did. He sat on me, he jumped in. First of all, I collected him in Manchester, and I'd got his basket and all his accoutrement, my bag, and I took a tram in Manchester, and he suddenly, I went to get off the tram, and he jumped off the tram and took me into the muddy street together with a basket and my bags. And so there's one flight lieutenant and one Springer Spaniel spread all over Manchester. Then we got to the railway station, and he jumped and sat on my lap all the way from Manchester to Lincoln. Wonderful dog. He was my sweetie dog. And I've still got Springers, of course. I've never been without a Springer since. I love Springers. And anyway, up to Montrose I go, and I learn to become a flying instructor. Learning to become a flying instructor is a bit like learning a play. Everything you do has got a patter. And the patter is laid down in a book, which is the instructor's Bible. If you go into a steep turn, you tell the pupil exactly what you are doing. And the words will be the same whether you say them, Jack Jones says them, or I say them. It's a play. And that is why RAF training is so good. Because it was so regular. I passed out as a flying instructor, and I came south. On the way south, I met Valerie again for the second time. And I was very tired. I knew that she'd got a 3-month-old baby. I felt that I should do something for the child. And I said, would you marry me? And she said, yes, I will. And there I was, catched. I'd got a baby, I'd got a wife, and I'd got a dog, all in one.
Complete family.
But I was glad, because quite honestly, coming back to that letter that you've seen in the museum, if you read the whole of it, it says, sometimes I would like a little boy to call my own so that he can carry on life perhaps where I leave off. So I did want my blood to carry on. So I was delighted when Valerie became pregnant with Nicholas. And we've been a very happy family ever since. Obviously, like every family, we've had our ups and downs. And believe you me, I haven't been the easiest person to live with. But it's been fun and tremendous challenge. And the kids love me, so that's enough. I think my wife does too, actually. But that's another story. And anyway, coming down, I came then south, and I was posted to Cramwell. And it was a wonderful posting, because just like Barclays Bank, Melbourne Court, Kensington, Cranwell was the creme de la creme. Couldn't have been posted to anywhere better. While I was arriving at Cranwell, the course into Montrose after me was, two of the people on the course was a bloke called Jimmy Renvoys, and Jimmy Renvoys was my flight commander, who was no longer a fighter pilot. They decided that he should have become an instructor as well. And he is coming down in the train from Montrose, and meanwhile I'd married. And with Jimmy Renvoys, of course, who knew or had known Susan Harris as a WAF officer at Portreath, was Susan Harris, together with her newly married husband, called Flight Lieutenant Chappell. And when I married, the Daily Mirror, of course, picked up the story from where I know not where, but the headlines were Third Time Lucky, query. And Jimmy Renvoys heard a bit of a fracas going on behind him in the railway train. And Flight Lieutenant Chappell said to Susan Harris, his new wife, I thought you told me this bugger was dead. As it so happened, skipping a little bit, I was standing at Kidlington as redundant aircrew at the end of the war, when Adams was shouted for, Bewley was shouted for, Berryman was shouted for, Baker was shouted for, and suddenly the word chapel behind me. And I swung round at the end of the parade and said, "Are you Flight Lieutenant Chapel that married Susan Harris?" He said, "Yes." I said, "How's Susan?" He said, "We're very happy. Come and have a pint." I can tell you a bit more about Susan away from the story, because it's rather a tragic story with her too. But at the time, there was I posted to Cranwell, and I was delighted to be asked to fly the Harvard again. I'd flown it while training. I was confident with it. I had probably about 200 hours on it, maybe three. And it was a nice aeroplane, easy to aerobat, and I think, in a way, although I was a bit of a mad hat, I think I was quite a reasonable instructor. I knew the rules, and I knew that what I would teach my pupils would either keep them alive or kill them, and I wasn't prepared to kill them. So I did my best as an instructor. Then my son was born. No, then I married, and we lived in Grantham, which was near to Cranwell. Had the dog with me. I married, and only 1 month after I was married, I was taken off flying. And I still believe that that had something to do with a much higher authority.
Why do you think you were?
I think they were not prepared to see a widow three times. Might be right, might be wrong.
Sounds plausible.
I was the only one taken off. I was a perfectly normal flying instructor.
How did it affect you?
Not at all. I was glad. I'd had enough. I'd done an awful lot. I mean, you know, fighter pilots and single engine pilots don't always knock up an awful lot of hours. But when you've done 1,000 odd hours, you've done an awful lot of takeoffs and an awful lot of landings.
You must have been quite unique flying Spitfires and Wolves.
I was. I was an oddball. And then to become an instructor, I was definitely a bit of an oddball. But not oddball enough not to be picked out as something that they didn't want to happen. The war was over. I was married May the 26th. The war finished, or the British war finished, about May the 5th. So May the 5th or May the 6th. So we were married 20 days after the war broke out, after the war finished. And I just think that it might have even been my friends, I don't know. I was with a queer bunch, when I say queer, in the nicest possible manner. I always got mixed up with the best people. I did. One of my fellow instructors was Johnny Tate, who later was Tate and Lyle, the Sugar People. And another one who was a landed gentry bloke in Sudbury in Suffolk. And when we married, they had an entree dish engraved for me to Flight Lieutenant and Mrs. Berryman from the flying instructors at Harlixton. I was just outside Grantham then, still with my dog. And my son has recently married, and I've been very proud to have that also engraved for him to Squadron Leader N.W. and Mrs. Berryman on the occasion of their marriage. And I hope like hell it gets down to Christopher, Wing Commander, one day.
What age is Christopher?
He's now 31 in the RAF Regiment and in Kuwait. He went into the regiment, did two tours in Ireland, and decided after two tours and some other comic job he did with the Royal Air Force that he wanted to come out. He went to Bradford University, took a degree in peace studies, passed out exceedingly well, very high up the course with an honours degree, and wrote to people like NATO and UNESCO, but none of them seemed to wanted the skills that he had. And but meanwhile, he had become training officer, RAF regiment training officer at RAF Waddington, and he knew his job. He was probably better than any of us ever had, apart from my son. I wasn't a professional, my son was, and so is Christopher. And he said to me one day, he said, you know, what the heck do I do? Nobody wants me. I said, why don't you go back in the mob? I said, with a degree, you've done 3 years at university. I said, you could do very well. Within a week of applying, he was in Kuwait. They're that badly off for personnel. He writes to me and he calls and sees me sometimes when he's home. He seems to get home about every 3 months. He's the busiest bloke in the Far East, or not Far East, the East. And he's very happy once again in the regiment. But meanwhile, where do we get with the... I was an instructor, and suddenly, what am I? I'm not an instructor anymore, and the RAF have to decide what to do with me. I went before a selection board, told them what I was. There are no flying jobs available for me. The RAF obviously didn't want me to have a flying job. But they thought I would make an ideal physical fitness officer. And very quickly, I found myself on the first course ever to go into RAF Cosford, which of course is the RAF fitness school, physical fitness school. In 1945, we were the first course ever to be sent in there. I told you about the program, the educational programs we made about McKenty and some birds in the Royal Air Force. They asked me what I knew about birds, and my answer wasn't quite right, nice over the telephone, but it made the young lady laugh. And so they made this program, and I did find a wonderful photograph of myself at RAF Cosford with McKenty sitting at my feet on this course photograph. And I noticed that I'm the only pilot out of 30 blokes in that photograph. Gunners, navigators, everything like one pilot. I still think, for some reason, somebody up there was keeping me safe. Because, generally speaking, we hadn't gone into the... We'd just about, by this time, won the Japanese war. But the RAF didn't know what they wanted, what they needed, but they didn't need me. And I was an above average sort of guy all the way through.
So the other men that you were with...
They were bomber command. They were all bomber command.
Where were they posted? Where were they?
They came from all over England, all over the world, to be posted to Cosford as physical fitness officers. Our job, and they were gunners, navigators, wireless operators, and it became quite obvious that our job was to keep the troops that had not yet been demobbed. Demobbed was the word. We had to keep them happy. Fortunately, with my background, Mercer schoolboy, good at athletics, I was a natural for the job. So I was able to become physical fitness officer, having passed out of Cosford, first of all at RAF Hucknall near Nottingham, where I got mixed up with all sorts of wonderful football players that played for Arsenal and Notts Forest, and we were all physical fitness officers together, but some of them were really professional footballers as well. And then I went from Hucknall to Peterborough and did a stint at Peterborough. Then Peterborough closed down, and I was posted to Curtin Lindsay. And Curtin Lindsay, of course, is just north of the city of Lincoln. It was then that Valerie's father said to me, by the time we'd got a child, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? And he was in the motor business. The motor business was in a very poor state because you didn't sell motor cars in wartime. petrol business was, he was a selected site for petrol retailing because rationing meant that there was only one in a district, probably only two in the whole of Lincoln where you could pick up petrol. Maybe only one. But he said, what are you going to do? So I said, well, I'm going back to the bank. So they said, how much bank are you going to pay you? So I said, £5.50 a week. I wasn't earning much more as a flight lieutenant. As a married flight lieutenant, I was being paid £30 a month. And he said, would you like a job with me? I didn't know the front end of a calf and the back end of a bull's foot, apart from the fact that I could drive one, because my father had given me the standard 9 that we used to have. He thought I might kill myself on a motorcycle that I had at Warmwell, and he gave me the standard 9. I could drive a car, and as he said in those days, drive it at 30 miles an hour, it'll last you a lifetime, drive it at 50 and it'll pack up within about 6 months. I drove that car religiously at 30 miles an hour. I wish people were more like that today sometimes. Having said that, I did drive up here at 70. But anyway, coming back to flying, I was posted to Curtin Lindsay, and there I was, what am I going to do? Just north of Lincoln, where he was in business, Valley was in business. I was a bit entrepreneurial, and knowing that my family had to have a house, I bought a house. There was a family in the house, and I did it very unwisely. It was a nice house, but it was cheap. And I must have a little bit of my boy in me, I think. And the house was cheap, and it was a good house, and I bought it with a tenants in it. And I just knew it was good. And it was in a lovely position, right up the hill near Lincoln Cathedral. But I couldn't get in it. And he said, if you don't go back to the bank and I paid you £5.50 a week, would you work for me? I said, yes, I would. And he said, in which case, I have enough money to move your tenants into another house and you can go into your house. And we lived at number 1 Chaucer Drive, Lincoln, where my son was born, literally. Well, you know, he lived and grew up. The two boys grew up together there. And I, not knowing anything much about motor cars, started to repair punctures, oil them, grease them, and generally service them as best I could. Whilst I was there, I got to know Andrew Humphrey, whom I told you was Chief of Defence Staff, but died before he really got into the job, and I used to service Andrew's motor car for him. One day he recognised the tie. He said he knew something about me. And by this time, he's the wing commander flying the Ares on the first of its big flights. The Ares was a record breaker, of course. And Andrew was definitely on the way up to the top of the Air Force and went to the very top. And, of course, I knew his brother, who was also a Lincoln man, Billy. So we formed a nice liaison there, and that liaison certainly did me no harm, because wherever I think Andrew or Billy were, they always spoke about their old friend. And I did sell an awful lot of motor cars eventually to the Royal Air Force, a lot. And because I'd got Waddington, Scampton, Hemswell, Curtin, Lindsay all around me, Manby. But that was later on. But for the time being, there am I, a grease monkey. And I remained a grease monkey and a petrol server, apart from the fact that I was offered a job by a bloke called Godfrey Holmes. Godfrey Holmes were big motor factors, big names in the motor factoring business. And he said to me one day, would you become my personal pilot? And I said, yes, I would. And I watched Valerie's face, and I couldn't take the job. She said, oh, no, please. So I remained a grease monkey for another 4 years. But I was learning the trade the hard way. I went to night school. I learned to weld. I learned to rebore, crank grind. and being pretty bright, there wasn't many a motor car that could break down on a Sunday night on the Skegness Road that I wouldn't have running in 5 minutes. They were, the old-fashioned motor car, there was nothing to them. I could get them running in 5 minutes. I can lift the bonnet on the modern motor car and I don't know the front from the back.
Did they all have handles
to crank? Yes, all sorts. But I soon became a very reasonable motor engineer by going to night school and working hard at it. And I used to work terribly hard. I didn't mind working hard. I loved being important. I loved being in the business. I loved getting people out of trouble. And the boys were going up. And they were about 4 and 5. And one day, I suddenly lost my rag with myself. And I thought, I'm a London schoolboy, London public school, bank clerk, father bank manager, pilot Royal Air Force, flight lieutenant Royal Air Force, flying instructor, and now I'm a grease monkey. And I went to my father-in-law, and I said, I ain't greasing any more motor cars unless you go out and get us an agency. I said, you know this firm that has a standard agency? I said, you know, go out and see what you said. You're a Freemason, go and see what you can do. Off he goes, comes back, we got the standard agency. We did, Standard and Triumph. Would have been about 1953. We need a foreman. We need a works manager. I become the works manager. It wasn't long before my RAF friends gathered around me and I was selling so many motors that I became the sales director. And then I got ambitious and I said, we need another garage because I want another agency. Well, he was easily persuaded because I think he had a lot of confidence in me. And we bought another garage. And I got Hillman, Humber and Sunbeam. And I sold a lot of those. By this time, we're into the world of the Vulcans, the big Vulcans. The Lancasters, the boys that I'd known and flown with, were now flying the Vulcans, if they had stayed. And I was very useful to them. They started to lose a lot of Vulcans. Accidents. And if nothing else, I was extremely fair, especially with my own kith and kin. And the RAF were my kith and kin. And I never let any of them down. If there was a widow with a car, I sold it and it didn't cost her a penny. She got every penny of what that motor car made. And, well, you remember you won't remember, but one of the Vulcans went in, crashed at London Airport. That was with Harry Broadhurst, whom I knew, and the co-pilot, or the first pilot really, was Podge Howard, Donald Howard, flying squadron leader, Royal Air Force, flying out of Waddington, and they'd broken a record, and it was decreed that they would fly into London Airport. The press were there. Anyway, the long and the short of it was, it didn't land, it bounced, went up into the fog again. The crew didn't bail out and they perished. But Harry Broadhurst bailed out and so did Don Podge Howard. But I used to sell all their motor cars if they were in trouble. And I had a very good name with the Royal Air Force. Then one day I decided I wasn't selling enough motor cars, so I needed Ford. I set out my stall and I was going to get Ford, and I got Ford. I had to build another garage to get it. And the firm was Parker Taylor and Company Limited, and that survived until I left it in 1965. And I left it for no other reason than my father-in-law had died, and there were other directors in the firm, two of which were women, and I was no way going to be ruled by a woman. Never had been. Never going to be. I love you all dearly, but I ain't being ruled by you.
Was one of the directors your wife?
Yes. Yes. And she never gave her a due. She never tried to rule me. But she was sometimes forced to side with her brother and her mother. And I had created the business. And so, in the nicest possible way, I one day said, I'm not doing it anymore. I'm going south, where I belong. I passed the business over to my stepson, David, who ran the business for another 10 years, together with his cousin. And it was a great success until...